please the court, the evidence here did not establish beyond a reasonable doubt that the glove in the glove compartment was there in relation to or in furtherance of drug trafficking. The drug expert testified that some, but not all, drug dealers use, carry, or possess guns to protect their drugs. He also testified that people have guns unrelated to drugs. Apparently, Americans have guns for many reasons. The Department of Justice has estimated that there are 230 million guns in America, and that 80 million of those are handguns. In 1994, the Department of Justice found that 14 million adults had at least once carried a gun in their car or on their person for protection.
Before you finish on the sufficiency, I just want to ask about the waiver question. So the government says that this is waived because the argument wasn't raised. A motion for judgment notwithstanding for a direction of a verdict wasn't made at the end of the government's evidence, citing the Sherrod case.
I believe that...
Am I wrong?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure that the government didn't make the argument, or you're not sure?
I somehow missed that entirely. I don't know whether I would have to go back and look at whether the defense lawyer made a motion again at the end of the defense.
Right. They argue in a footnote that it's waived because of that. But so you don't know whether they did or not.
I apparently missed that footnote, and okay. But I will look to see if what happened there.
I'll ask the government because I actually think it was made. But and maybe that's why it was left in the footnote, but we'll ask about that in a second.
Okay. Given the prevalence of guns in our society and given the prevalence of handguns in our society, and experts' testimony that some drug dealers use, carry, or possess guns to protect their drugs is not enough to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Wheeler had the gun for the purpose of protecting his
Well, he had the gun. It was readily accessible to him, and it was a gun that it was unlawful for him to carry because he was a felon, and among other reasons. And there were a large number of small bags, which were obvious for distribution, but based on the expert's testimony, in close proximity. What else do you think you need?
Mr. Wheeler does not dispute that he possessed with intent to distribute drugs. He does not dispute that he possessed a firearm after being convicted of a felony. Uh-huh. But there is no nexus here between the gun and the drugs.
Well, there are a lot of cases in quite a number of circuits in which that was enough. What more do you want? What more do you think needs to be? What's the absolute minimum required?
All of the cases repeat the statement that concurrent possession is not enough. Right. And that's what we have here, concurrent possession.
So your position is that you actually have to
have something else
like
that would
what?
Show
like
a...
If you had the gun sitting on top of the drugs, that would be...
Certainly, if there was evidence of distribution while he was in possession of the car.
What does that mean? Is there any indication anywhere by any expert that... When somebody is distributing the drugs, they're doing it with a gun drawn?
With a gun drawn?
Yeah.
No, but it doesn't have to be drawn. If you're distributing drugs out of your car window and you have a gun in the car,
Why do drug dealers carry guns? They don't carry the guns to distribute the drugs. That's my point. So why does it matter whether there's distribution at the time of the seizure or sometime later? Why do they carry guns?
According to the expert, they carry guns to protect themselves from violence and to protect their product from theft.
Right.
That is why to protect themselves from violence is presumably why all of these 14 million Americans who have carried a gun in their car or on their person do it. People carry guns for protection. That doesn't link them to drugs.
Presumably, they're not engaging in illegal activity. They're protecting themselves from illegal activity. But that's not true with respect to your client.
Well, there's no there's nothing in the record that would suggest, you know, perhaps you could infer that he has a gun.
Or a jury.
A jury could infer that he has a gun to protect his product or himself in violent neighborhoods, but it's equally likely that he has a gun simply for protection, just like many, many Americans carry a gun, use a gun, possess a gun, simply for protection. And there is nothing here beyond that concurrent possession. There's no testimony that it, you know, that
isn't the question what the jury could infer from this? There doesn't have to be anything else. It's a question of circumstantial evidence. The only question is whether a reasonable jury could infer this. That's the standard, whether any reasonable juror could reach that conclusion based on this.
Where there are other equally reasonable inferences.
Even if there are other equally reasonable inferences, the question is whether any reasonable juror could conclude this.
Without some connection between the two, with simply concurrent possession, it's not reasonable.
What if it was on his belt while he was distributing? Why is that anything other than concurrent possession? You said that would be enough.
If you have it on your belt while you're actually distributing drugs, I think the inference is a lot stronger.
It is stronger. There's no doubt about that. But the question, let me assume for the moment that you lost on the sufficiency question.
Okay.
That there is sufficient evidence of carrying. Right? Under Muscarello, there's no question that being in a locked glove compartment is sufficient.
Right.
Assume that there is sufficient evidence of possession and furtherance, because he was found guilty of possessing the gun. And assume, I want you to assume that this evidence that we've been talking about is sufficient for furtherance. Okay?
Okay.
And assume that you're correct, which you are, that the instruction on using was incorrect. Well, it seems to me that there are at least three cases that neither party is citing that resolve this, and I'm not sure why that is. So in United States versus Green and United States versus Johnson and United States versus Perkins, which is cited in the brief but for a different purpose, we discussed the functional equivalence issue. That is, where the defendant has been found guilty of a functionally equivalent offense, that is sufficient even if one of the instructions is wrong. So in the old days, when using and carrying was the only issue, if the person had been found guilty of carrying without a license, for example, that was sufficient even if the instruction on using was wrong. So in this case, he was found guilty of possessing as the gun, right? There's no doubt about that, constructive possession.
Right.
Okay. And there's only one gun, right?
Right.
And the gun is in the glove compartment.
Right.
Okay. So, and he was also either found guilty, under any of these theories, he was found guilty either of using, your theory is he was found, I'm sorry, this isn't very clear, let me start over again. Under your theory, he could have been found guilty of using during and in relationship to a drug crime,
yes.
Right? All right. So that meant the jury would have had to have found both using and during in relation to, right? Okay. Using is wrong, right? But we know that he was carrying. Because he was found guilty of the functional equivalent of carrying.
Okay.
So why isn't that enough?
The reason that is not enough is because there was an element to carry that the jury didn't necessarily
reach. What was that?
Ready accessibility.
Okay, so.
And even though evidence might be sufficient.
Could I hold for one second? Your argument that ready accessibility is required for carry comes from the Lynn case, right?
It comes from
United States versus Lynn.
Well, there are other cases in this circuit.
Which cases say that carry requires ready accessibility? The one you cite is Lynn.
I think Johnson.
What?
I'm sorry, Joseph. A 1999 case. And there the focus of the issue was on conveyance, the conveyance element, but
it wasn't convey
But the court said that there, for, that there must be ready accessibility.
That's it, when it's not in a car, right?
No, this was conveyed, I believe.
It was in a tote bag, right? Yeah, okay, so let me just explain what I think is going on here, okay? In Joseph, they refer to the requirement of dominion and control and ready accessibility. But what the court says is that applies only when there is not a conveyance, not when there is a conveyance, because in Muscarello, the court expressly held that ready accessibility is not required when it's carried in a car. That's what the Supreme Court held in Muscarello. Right? Because in Muscarello, the court said if it's in a locked trunk of the car, that's good enough.
Well, the court said on page 13.
Which case?
Of Joseph.
Uh-huh. The discussion on Joseph at page 14 makes clear that Muscarello said you didn't need ready accessibility, but if we're not talking about a car, then you have to have both. Evans applies. And let me just read to you from Muscarello, which
yes, no, under any theory
trumps our own opinion. It says, petitioners argue we should construe the word carry to mean immediately accessible. Nothing in the statute's history suggests Congress intended that limitation.
And then the cases subsequent to Muscarello in this circuit and others, I believe, have held that carry still has an element of convenient accessibility.
And how could that be when the Supreme Court said what I just said?
Well, regardless, the fact is that the Supreme Court case is directly on point. It talks about conveying a firearm in a vehicle in a locked glove compartment. This was a vehicle, this was a firearm, this was in a locked glove compartment, and it was during a drug offense.
And so the element of transporting is met, but the element of accessibility is not.
Right. Assume you're wrong on accessibility. Assume that when you go back and look at Joseph, you find that it is as I describe it. So then you have a conviction on constructive possession of the gun that's in the glove compartment. You have the Supreme Court's opinion in Muscarello saying that that's enough for carrying. You concede that the jury must have found during and in relation to, one way or the other, with respect to using or carrying.
No, I don't want to make that concession.
Well, you want to withdraw that concession then, because that's what you told me before. How do you think the jury convicted?
Oh, I thought I was just agreeing with your assumptions for purposes of...
Fair enough. How did the jury convict? What wrong
well,
theory?
The jury had three methods, use, carry, or possession,
yes.
And they had two standards
right.
in relation to or in furtherance
right.
of. And we don't know which one they found.
Well, in furtherance of is stricter than you than.
But it is not necessarily simply in relation to plus.
Really? Can you tell me any case that says, the Seventh Circuit says that's what it is. Do you have any case?
I don't have any cases that say that's not what it is.
Well, under what circumstance would something be in furtherance of but not during and in relation to? What would the example be?
Well, in relation to means, the Supreme Court has said, for example, in regards.
Yeah.
And in furtherance of means something that promotes.
Right. So in furtherance of means at least to further a drug crime, right? In what sense would that also not be in regard to a drug crime?
Well, they are... There are different standards, and I'm not willing to say that it's in regards plus. There is another problem, and that is that
you're way over your time. So
may I make this very quick point? The in relation to instruction also was wrong, because the jury was instructed that as to carrying, the, that in relation to may require more than mere presence. And that is a wrong statement of the law.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Ambrosino for the United States. I'm joined at council table by Chief of the Appellate Division, Roy McLeese, and also by trial counsel, Tony Quinn. I'll begin with the sufficiency issue and go directly to the issue of a nexus between...
Before you do, just on the waiver question. So when I look at the transcript of June 23rd in the morning, page 76, the judge says, there's a discussion of the Brisbane issue. The judge said, I assume that at the close of the evidence now that Ms. Lotz would renew the motion for judgment of acquittal. Ms. Lotz, yes, Your Honor. That's at page 76.
I would concede that would suffice, Your Honor.
So we're out of waiver territory.
We're out of waiver, Your Honor. In discussing the nexus between the gun from the glove compartment and the drugs that were handed to the date.
So why did you put that in your brief?
I missed it, Your Honor.
Oh. I mean, you didn't look it up to see whether it had been waived?
I read the entire transcript, Your Honor. I honestly must have missed it. I would, in turning to the factors adopted by this court, and while I would highlight three factors for the court to focus on. First, that the amount of crack cocaine was $1,600 worth of crack, obviously providing appellant with a very strong motive to protect his merchandise. Secondly, the proximity of the drugs and the firearm to one another. They were both within arm's reach of appellant.
Where was it? Is there any evidence that the packets of crack were between the two seats in the front? Is that where they found?
That's where they were recovered, Your Honor.
But where were they? What is the evidence regarding where they were before the police approached the vehicle?
Unclear. Only that they were handed by appellant to the front seat passenger. So I think the only reasonable inference that can be gleaned from that was that they were either on his possession or within hands or within arm's reach because he was driving at the time. And there's no evidence that he got out of the front seat as he's being pulled over. And so the second factor would obviously demonstrate easy access.
No evidence they were in the glove compartment?
No, Your Honor. No, there's no evidence that the glove compartment was open prior to the time the front seat passenger opened the glove compartment in compliance with the orders of the police. And finally, I'd point to the fact that this was a fully loaded firearm, and it was a handgun, and so it was obviously easy to hide and yet fully capable of protecting the drug proceeds. And so in looking at the factors of law...
Well, if it was a AK-47, you'd have exactly the same argument for the opposite reason, though, wouldn't you? If he had an AK-47, which was not easy to hide,
it wouldn't fit in the glove compartment.
But it would be stronger evidence of in further evidence, wouldn't it?
Certainly, Your Honor. It could be seen as further evidence. I'm not sure that you'll see as many cases of AK-47s being driven around in cars. And that was part of Sergeant Brennan's testimony, that one of the reasons drug dealers often use handguns is that they're easy to secret. And often found, we cite one case where it's recovered after we cite Muscarello, we cite there was a case of Wilson, Your Honor, where it's recovered from a dashboard. And obviously, there's a number of other cases where handguns are recovered from glove compartments, such as Muscarello. Turning to the instructional error issue.
Could I just ask one question? We've had Bailey cases the entire time that I've been on the court, and for many years before that. How can we still be using the wrong instruction on using?
I wish I had a good answer for that.
Well, could I suggest to the appellate section that they send a memo around with a standard instruction on using so that we don't see this again?
Your Honor, when I said I wish I had a good explanation for why it was used for this trial, I can assure the court that I have gone to both the narcotics section and the major crime sections, which are the two sections of our office that do, in fact, utilize this instruction. And the one that is currently being used does, in fact, track the statutory language, and it makes clearly differs between the verbiage use and carry in relation to, as opposed to...
We don't want to track the statutory language. We want to use the Supreme Court's opinion in Bailey's language for using, right?
I understood, Your Honor. I'm just saying that the confusing language that was contained in the instructions in this case is not in the current instruction that's being utilized by the office.
Okay. And why don't you like the functional equivalence cases? Or why don't you think they resolve this case?
I think they do, Your Honor. And in discussing functional equivalence, before I get there, I would like to just note for the record that, of course, there was a standing instruction by the court, standing order by the court for joint instructions. And although it's a little unclear as to how the instructions got to the court, what is clear is that in the three times that the instruction on Section 924C that was read to the jury, there was no objection lodged. And in fact, at the conclusion of the evidence...
So that gives us plain error as
plain
the test,
error
that's all.
It. But essentially, I think that the crux of appellant's claim boils down to two points, and that is that the definition of use was overly broad, and that the government argued use in addition to possession to the jury. And looking at the record in this case, the only theory that can be gleaned from this record is that that firearm in the glove compartment was used to protect those drug proceeds. And so even if there is the possibility that appellant was convicted under the wrong subsection, i.e. possess as opposed to, use as opposed to possess, there is no risk that the conduct for which he was convicted fell outside the four corners of 924C. And clearly, the government's theory, which was possession or use of that gun to protect those drug proceeds, falls under possession in furtherance of or carrying in relation to. And so I would agree with Your Honor. I think clearly those two subsections of 920C were clearly satisfied, and plain error cannot be demonstrated. The third prong of the plain error analysis can simply not be satisfied because there's no risk or chance that appellant was convicted for conduct that fell outside the scope of the statute. If there are no other questions from the bench, I would submit and ask for the judgment to be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you a minute, Ms. Rowe.
With regard to the factors cited by the government and by this court, that this court has adopted from the Fifth Circuit, I think the relevance of the fact that it was a handgun, I think really has no relevance. It reminds me of the days when experts testified that pagers and cell phones were tools of the trade. Guns are everywhere. Handguns are everywhere. It is not evidence necessarily of using the gun.
We said that if it was an illegal gun, that would make a difference. And it's not illegal just because it's hard to have a gun in the District of Columbia. It's illegal because he's a felon in possession. That's what makes his possession federally unlawful.
Right, but I don't think that there's any connection between owning a gun illegally and it doesn't make it more likely that
we
you
said,
are using your gun.
We said it made a difference, right?
I think that that's wrongly decided. I think the fact that it's loaded is not relevant.
It's relevant, but would you agree that if instead of a handgun in a glove compartment, there had been a .30-06 with a scope on it in the trunk, that would make a difference? Do you know what a .30-06 rifle is?
I don't.
Yeah, it's a deer hunting rifle.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't think that we have
that
to...
With a scope on it, that wouldn't make a difference? That'd make it much
I don't know what the scope does for it.
Well, you would argue that that's not in connection with drug dealing, that's in connection with hunting, right? But you don't
yes,
have that.
Yes, but we don't need to show that there's that this is an antique wall-mounted gun. They need to show, beyond a reasonable doubt, that there's a nexus between the gun and the drugs, that they aren't simply possessed concurrently. And so I don't think you have to look for, there doesn't have to be evidence of hunting gun or an antique gun. It's just, was this handgun something that many, many people own, possessed, carried, used in connection with?
Okay, we got that. Thank you.